Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to audio and video content, episode archives, monthly roundtables, a book club, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Lots of people have lots to say about the Bible. Loads of conspiracy theories exist about it, whether it's conspiracy theories about its creation or lost books that didn't make the cut, or obscure interpretations seen by a select few as prophecy about our modern world. Not a day goes by that someone, somewhere, isn't holding the Bible up to the light and seeing if we missed anything. Beyond that, so-called biblical literalism has been the basis of support for a lot of pretty heinous parts of our country's past and present. From regulating the sale of alcohol, to vilifying interracial marriage and queer identity, to demonizing immigrants, to supporting slavery. Supposed biblical scholars have found a way to twist the Bible in such a way that it is a timeless scapegoat for current hatred. All of this turns a lot of people off from not just modern Christianity, but of religion in general. Few scholars wish to use their time, energy, or knowledge to combat the misinformation and vitriol online. But thankfully, my guest today does just that. Dan McClellan is a scripture translation supervisor for the LDS Church. Don't stop listening. With a PhD in theology and religion. He's also taken a turn at running for public office as a Democrat in Utah. He's also a fierce ally of the queer community, a debunker of conspiracy theories, and a Marvel fan. We had a lot to talk about. Enjoy the interview. Dan McClellan, welcome to Head on Fire. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Is that a Marvel shirt that I see?
It is, yeah. I have quite a bit of Marvel apparel, and I'm always on the lookout for more.
Yeah, if you look slightly to the right of where I'm sitting to do this interview, it is just encyclopedias and all my old issues and way too much Jean Grey paraphernalia.
Yeah, X-Men were formative for me in my teenage years, but so were Image Comics had just come around in the 90s.
And man.
Things like Spawn and Gen 13, some of those things were also big for me. I don't see enough of that merch out there. I need to find some Spawn t-shirts or something like that.
Yeah, I feel like Spawn is the only sort of like 90s comic property that's really due for like a proper reboot.
Yeah. Some of the cartoon was a little rough. I think they made at least one movie. Did they make another one?
They did. Well, I don't know that they ever made a sequel, but I do know that movie was, that was the right tone for that movie. I think it was a bit ahead of its time.
Yeah. And it was John Leguizamo, wasn't it?
He was the clown dude. Yeah. I would love to sit here and chat with you about, comic books all day long, because I definitely could, but I asked you here today to talk about what you do professionally. So for folks that don't know you or your platform, tell people a little bit about yourself.
Well, my name is Dan McClellan. I go by the handle McClellan, M-A-K-L-E-L-A-N. That's how I spelled my last name phonetically for folks in South America when I was serving as a missionary down there for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints 20 years ago. And I got on TikTok on the 30th. It will be 1 year to the day that I was on TikTok because I saw videos being shared on some other social media platforms, on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook. And every now and then it would overlap with my own research interests. And I my dissertation was on cognitive linguistics and the cognitive science of religion, the conceptualization of deity in the Hebrew Bible. And so I'm a biblical scholar, and I also work in some aspects of the study of religion And I saw some of these videos being shared and thought, it doesn't sound like there are any referees or anything over there if there's a lot of this misinformation being shared. So I thought I would go take a look and lurk for a little while, and decided to start responding to some of the videos on there in an effort to try to combat a lot of this misinformation, because the world of biblical scholarship can be pretty compartmentalized and siloed. And so it takes a long time for information to disseminate in the public. And so a lot of the information that people are using to create a lot of the content that is related to biblical studies right now is really decades and even centuries old. And so it's a lot of very outdated frameworks, very outdated data. And there are some folks doing a very good job trying to get us up to date. Even a lot of the folks who do this as a hobby or as part of, some research they're doing as a for their church, or folks who are pastors and things like that, who are trying to put a more critical eye on the Bible, a lot of times don't have access to a lot of the scholarship. So I thought, well, that seems to be a gap in the coverage of the content on TikTok, and perhaps I can fill that gap. And so I specialize in cognitive linguistics, the cognitive science of religion, and kind of biblical studies in general. And I try to share information, keep people up to date on where things are in biblical studies. But for the most part, I'm here to try to combat misinformation. So I do a lot of stitching other folks' videos when they're getting a lot of attention, sharing stuff that is a little misguided or downright deceptive or based on bad data, and sometimes there can be some harmful rhetoric that is out there being shared as well. And at this point, there does not seem to be any end to the misinformation on TikTok.
TikTok is the new Tumblr, which was the new Facebook, which was, anytime we get a new form of social media, it just seems like we do a whole lot of discourse over again. We thought we had settled. I feel like there might be some people out in the audience that heard Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints 20 years mm-hmm. ago and instantly think they know what the rest of this interview is going to sound like.
they're wrong.
any of your media on social media. Yeah. Your platform, I discovered doing a couple of things. One, debunking some interesting historical claims about objects that are, purportedly related to the historical figure of Jesus, or mm-hmm. Debunking what, the Bible allegedly really says here or there. Mm-hmm. You've gotten a lot of heat about, a video that keeps coming up for you, especially in recent days, given the preliminary Supreme Court decisions, is your videos on homosexuality in the Bible. What do you consider as the space that you occupy? Maybe talk to me a little bit about, let's go ahead and go over some of those views on, the historical accuracy of certain objects, mm-hmm. and maybe dive into homosexuality a bit.
Okay. Regarding the objects, are you talking about the Jordan led codices or?
I've seen several videos of yours now where, you've talked about nails that were allegedly, from Jesus' tomb, possibly inside of Jesus, at some point. I think you did did you do one on the Shroud of Turin? I think
I may have once referenced the Shroud of Turin, but yeah, there are a lot of folks who are posting videos where they're sharing a lot of relics mm-hmm. and other things that have been traditionally linked with Jesus and with other figures, the Ark, chariots supposedly found in the Red Sea, stuff like that. There's mm-hmm. there's a lot of that going on, and some of these date back pretty early. Some of these relics may go back to the 4th century. There's a lot of the places and the objects that have for a long time been traditionally associated with the life of Christ came to be associated with this when Constantine institutionalized Christianity, and you had a lot of people traveling to Jerusalem. And there are a lot of stories about Constantine's mother, for instance, going around and saying, we're looking for, you know, stuff related to Jesus. And they were like, oh yeah, he was born right over there. And, you know, and this was his crown of thorns. And that gets then taken back and treated for centuries as this relic that for a long time, particularly in medieval Christianity, have been thought to have special powers. I hesitate to say magical powers, but really that's what's going on, that there is some kind of agency endowed in these objects that allows them to heal people and bring about certain events. But I think there's an old movie on Martin Luther with Ray Fiennes, where he says there are enough pieces of the true cross to build rebuild a ship or something like that. What did he say? 15 of the 12 apostles are buried in Spain, you know, and things like that. So when we kind of dig down into the provenance of these items, mm-hmm. usually they are popping up either in that fourth, fifth century, kind of real early in the start of Christianity's interest in these objects, these relics, or at some point in the medieval period, 800, 900, 1000 CE, 1200, 1400. So the Shroud of Turin is probably in that middle area there. And some of these other objects are definitely, you know, less than 1,000 years old. But from our perspective, you know, they look really, really old. And sure. So for folks who have a desire to experience some kind of physical proximity to something divine, that's a very inviting kind of thing. And that's the reason that this is so so common, is because folks who believe in deity want to interact with deity, want to feel the presence of deity. And we have kind of an intuitive predisposition to materiality. We want to touch, feel, see, smell. We want to experience the materiality of these things. And so that's why divine images were so common anciently, is that's a means of facilitating access to that agency and that presence. And so it's no surprise to me that that we still have a lot of examples of this, although Protestantism has the iconoclasm of Protestantism, the rejection of images, things like that, that's all resulted in a brand of Christianity that is much more interiorized. But, you know, that doesn't mean that humanity loses that desire for that kind of thing. So, but yeah, it's been bizarre how many different things pop up from time to time.
What do you think people look for? What do you think people are looking for in searching for archaeological proof of historical events?
Like I said, I think there's a degree to which people want to experience some kind of proximity to that. They want mm-hmm. to see something that they that makes them think this is real, and that fills them with, you know, that can fill them with all kinds of different emotions if they are convinced that this is something that belonged to the Apostle Peter or Jesus or Noah or something like that. But I think there's a degree to which it is also a compulsion to respond to the rational critique of religiosity. I think with Protestantism and then the Enlightenment, there was this dichotomy of rational religion versus revealed religion. And rational religion gives way to a lot of different kinds of critiques of the supernatural. And when we get into the 19th century, we have the theory of evolution. We're discovering a lot of things paleontologically, geologically, that challenge a lot of the ideologies of Christianity and of the religions associated with the Bible. And so as that rationalism encroaches upon what religion feels is its territory. It wants to dig in its heels and push back. And so even though a lot of folks will say the foundation has to be faith, blessed are those who have not seen and have believed, there is still an impulse also to push back and say, no, we have perfectly rational basis for these beliefs. And so there is a push in a lot of ways to try to come up with rational explanations. And so it's odd, folks will talk about miracles like the parting of the Red Sea, ostensibly a miracle, but you'll have folks say, well, over here, it was really shallow and there was this huge gust of wind. And so the wind pushed all the water out of the way. And there's a perfectly natural explanation for how this miracle could have happened.
That's a heck of a lot of wind.
Like, is it a miracle or is it a perfectly natural event? And so the wedding of naturalism and miracles and the supernatural to suggest that the supernatural operates entirely through natural processes and things like that, I think is a way to try to answer the critique of rationalism while still holding on to the supernatural. But I think it's also different for everybody, and people have a lot of different motivations.
I grew up in a really small town, Southern Baptist, 9 Baptist churches, 585 people. We had, way more churches per capita than we needed. So I grew up in an environment that I think allegedly preached biblical literalism certainly tried to do many of the things that you're talking about here. And placed a lot of value in those kinds of texts. And that kind of environment can feel very alienating to people that are not, that don't find themselves blessed by those texts, that find themselves on the outside of those texts.
Yeah.
Queer kids don't tend to find a great home in the church. They grow up feeling pretty much like an outsider, myself included. And so I was interested to see your many videos on your take on queer identity as it is or is not discussed in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit more about that. Why did you feel that was so important to bring to the to social media?
Well, it is something that pops up a lot. When I first got on TikTok, I have my research interests and they can be broad in some ways and very narrow in other ways. But one of the things that I did was try to find out where a lot of the audience's interests lie and see if there's overlap with my own research in that. So I can kind of tag the bases that more folks are going to be interested in. Obviously, that's something that comes up a lot. It's so important to a lot of traditions, and it is something that is so salient in our national discourse today. And I think there are things that need to be said about the deployment of these texts for these rhetorical purposes. Mm-hmm. And something I try to point out is from my cognitive linguist background, that these texts don't really have any inherent meaning. The meaning is something that we bring to them. We create the meaning in our minds, and that's frequently guided by what we want to get out of the text, what presuppositions we're bringing to the text, what identity politics we're bringing to the text. And so I think it is, and I think that's perfectly valid. I mean, that's how we enjoy literature and art and things like that, is by negotiating with this. How is this going to help me better understand myself and give meaning to my experiences? And that's how we enjoy all kinds of different modes of art. But when we are doing that in order to harm others, in order to draw lines around, draw certain people in and draw certain people out in ways that can lead to children taking their own lives, children feeling marginalized, oppressed, vilified, having their worth taken from them. That is phenomenally harmful. And so I felt like I had something that I could add to that discussion because of my expertise in the text. And really, there, when you go try to reconstruct what these texts meant to their original authors and audiences. That's not just a process of saying, how is this useful meat to me today? And then just assuming that it matches what they did in antiquity. It's a very difficult, very complex process. And when you go through it for these texts in antiquity, you find we don't know a lot of what they were thinking. And what we can reconstruct of the conceptual frameworks with which they were working, they're very, very different from what we're thinking today. And so I've made it a handful of videos that have touched on these texts and from a few different angles. And I'm working on a more long form YouTube video that will kind of consolidate all my thinking on this, but it's kind of complex. I want to get it right. So it's taking a little longer, but in short, what they have said and what they have not said show that the concern is something we can't pinpoint. And if we can't pinpoint precisely what the concern was, I don't think we are justified in importing it wholesale into today and saying, well, we'll just fill in the gaps with our own conceptual frameworks. That does violence to what those texts were written to do in antiquity. And I've talked about it a little bit with Paul as well, that his sexual ethic was very idiosyncratic and unique and contingent on the normative frameworks and sexual ethics of first century Greece and Rome, where he was celibate, thought the second coming was any day now. And so there was really no time for marriage or sex. But, you know, if you couldn't control yourself, go ahead and get married just so that you can suppress your urges. Every time I read the part in Corinthians about it is better to marry than to burn, I think of the Simpsons where Ned Flanders, I forget what he's eating, but he's drinking or eating something. And he says, good for keeping down the urges. And that's really a great framing of what Paul seems to be saying marriage is for. It's not for passion. He hates passion. It's to keep passion at bay. And so he talks about sex that is honorable and dispassionate, and then contrast that with what those dirty Gentiles do with their passionate and dishonorable sex. And so, like, if we imported Paul to today and sat down with him in a coffee shop and asked him about these things, I think most people would be horrified at the positions he would take. And so I don't think we're justified in just saying, well, Paul didn't seem to like the arsenokite, and we can just kind of squint at that and say, yeah, we have a similar idea here, and so we're just going to say they match. That's not justified. They don't match. And if we want to try to import their values, we can't just arbitrarily pick and choose which aspects of those values we're going to take and then how we're going to fill out the rest of the picture. That's just arbitrary. That's just engaging in identity politics. It is looking for a proof text to serve an ideology. And I think I've commented a number of times about how I don't think there is such a thing as biblical literalism, because the literalists will immediately appeal to figurative, metaphorical, non-literal interpretations if they need to serve their ideologies. The ideologies are the priority. The texts are just the tool. And well, so
there's plenty of times whenever biblical literalism, suddenly they're, you know, a biblical literalist sweating bullets because it's like, well, why am I eating shrimp? Why am I doing, you know, X, Y, or Z thing? Oh, well, yeah. It's okay for me to ignore this part of the literal interpretation of the Bible because of all of these reasons, all of these very good reasons that I have invented or I have been taught, but we must abide very strictly by these other things,
right?
Because of other arbitrary reasons.
And that's why I thought that the video I reposted, I think it was this morning, it might've been yesterday, where I talked about the creation of this division of the Hebrew Bible laws into ceremonial and civic and moral. And they're like, well, we can get rid of the don't wear two fabrics at the same time one, because that was just ceremonial or civic or whatever. But these moral ones, these are eternal. And it's like, well, that's not a biblical principle you're asserting there. That was created centuries later so that we could pick and choose which ones we were going to keep and which ones we were not. It was a rationalization to serve someone's identity politics. And I know I feel bad because I have to sound like a broken record with as much as I talk about identity politics. And I've tried to share some thoughts on what I mean when I say that. But so much of how the Bible is used really comes down to somebody needing to use it to serve their own identity politics and advance their social standing or engage in boundary maintenance or protect their institution or their own positionality. And I think that's what's so important about this process of deconstruction that has become so, so well known today, is because that's really breaking everything down so you can see the motivations behind this and see what is actually compelling being good, cooperation, love, you know, advancing our community, and what is being compelled by money or by power or identity politics. And so to the degree that deconstruction helps people parse those things apart, I think it is phenomenally important and phenomenally helpful. So I feel bad that it gets a bad rap for a lot of folks, but you know, they're engaged in those identity politics and are too deep in it to see beyond it, I think.
I will join you in sounding a bit like a broken record, because I'm going to bring up the Supreme Court again, but only to mention the fact that in Alito's opinion, in his drafting of the opinion of the court, which we have not seen yet, so it could change still, he said that basically any ruling that wasn't deeply rooted in history is, you know, up for the chopping block.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that, about the idea of something being deeply rooted in history, is that we, you know, if we go by that standard, we've seen that the Constitution is not nearly as old as the Bible. It's a few hundred years old, but who was a person back then and who is a person now? Yeah. Who was 3/5 of a person then and who's 3/5 of a person now? Who could own land? Who could vote? Who could all of those things? They have all changed wildly in the last few hundred years. What words meant have wildly changed. The word literally no longer means something that actually verifiably happened. It means, it, you know, enthusiasm or something. So I find it interesting in a discussion of translation and of objectively studying a text that's not just a couple of hundred years old, we're talking thousands of years old, and trying to glean how to live a life from that text. I'm curious, and I don't want to get into your personal faith because I don't know that that's truly relevant here. I'm curious about how you objectively understand books like the Bible and other spiritual texts. How do you view them? What do you think they are for us today? Are they books of inspiration? Are they, you know, indelible instructions for the universe?
Yeah, I don't think there is much that we could say is unchanging or static, because I don't think texts have any inherent meaning. Everything is up to be for renegotiation. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we have a responsibility. We ought to be trying to build our exegetical frameworks, the tools we're using to interpret texts. I think if we build them on sincere and concerted efforts to reconstruct the worldviews of the authors, the rhetorical goals of the authors, the context of the audiences, things like that, I think that's a better foundation on which to build. But there's always going to be a degree to which we're negotiating with the text and trying to find a way to make it relevant to our lives. And that's going to mean injecting a little bit of ourselves in the in the text. And even just picking and choosing what we're going to look at kind of is not objective. If we weighted everything equally, then we wouldn't really be able to decide what we're going to look at and what not. But when we focus in on things, we're already imposing a bias on these texts. And so I think there's no true objective way of engaging with these texts. I think we can try to minimize the bias as much as possible. And I try to do that from an academic point of view, but devotional readers of the text, I think as long as you kind of keep that at least there to as kind of a reference point, so that you're not just going off the deep end. As long as people find value, find meaning in the text, find that the text can help them, help inform their experiences and things like that, I think that's a perfectly valid use of the text. I get frustrated when that leads into trying to divide people up and assign value to people, which is unfortunately what it almost invariably does. We feel like one of the ways to advance our own interests is always seems to be to do it on the backs of others. And unfortunately, because of the nature of religious texts and ideologies and identity politics and institutions, drawing boundaries is frequently an indelible part of all that. So yeah, it's complex. I tell people in my congregation here, when people contact me about help with engaging the scriptures, I tell them, try to start from that foundation of what the authors were most likely trying to achieve and what the audiences were most likely hoping to get out of the text. But if frequently that's going to be meaningless to somebody. There are a bunch of texts where people are like, what does this really mean? And I tell them, and they're like, that means nothing to me. And it's like, yeah, that's going to be the case a lot of times. And you can jettison the text. You can get rid of it and say, all right, I'm done with that. I don't have to look at that anymore. Or you can say, well, maybe there's something in there for me. Maybe there's a way I can use this text as a lens to put on my own life, my own experiences, my own background, so that I can learn something new. I can find a new way to think about these things, find a new way to find meaning in my experiences. And I think that enriches a life. So I think as long as people are moving forward and are finding ways to enrich their life with these texts, I'm all for it. But once they start using them as bludgeons, as weapons, that's when it becomes problematic. And that's when I butt in and say, that's wrong. That's not what that was trying to do. And so I hope I don't come across as too much of a bully for folks who are just trying to, just trying to find joy in their living their lives and in their families and in their communities. I try not to come down on folks like that.
I don't think people that are finding joy or inspiration in the text are the people that would think you're a bully. Like the people that want you to say, no, it's okay for you to use the book to support banning interracial marriage. No, it's totally okay for you to use that to ban abortion or to ban, yeah, this, that, or the other thing. I think those people are pretty upset with you.
Yeah. And that's an occupational hazard. I'm happy to upset those folks, not because I don't like them personally, but because everybody needs somebody. The folks who are going down that road need to be disrupted. They will be happier if they can be disrupted and if they can change their path. I think most people, I'm speaking for myself primarily, I have gone down bad paths in my own past, and it has taken someone who has had to slap me around a bit and say, that's bad, stop doing that. And it's been uncomfortable, and I have felt embarrassed, And, you know, it's not been an enjoyable experience, but I'm so thankful for that because it woke me up to the fact that I had blinders on and I wasn't seeing how the words I was using, the ideologies I was deploying were harming other folks. And so most of the people that I engage with, I get this question all the time. Do those people ever respond to you? And frequently they do. And sometimes people will just, you know, whine and complain and block me or, you know, call me a bully or something like that. But there are frequently folks who say, well, thank you for teaching me that. It was something I needed to learn and I'm going to do better now. And I wish they could all be that outcome, because not only does that just mean, you know, we've overcome this ignorance, we've corrected this error, but this is somebody who's hopefully going to start down a better path now and not just not harm other people, but their lives are going to be better. They're going to be happier. And I would much rather see that than dunk on somebody and have them, you know, delete their account. That doesn't make me feel good. That makes me feel bad because I know that person is, you know, they're not going to change because of that. And I've made them feel bad. And so I'm still wrestling with that aspect of this kind of discourse, with how to feel about those kinds of things. But when people are like, oh, this is so amazing. Look at what these, you know, evil Catholics did, this conspiracy theory, or, you know, kind of blithely appealing to anti-Semitic rhetoric. Like that doesn't, you know, it's just a blind spot. They're not bad people, I don't think, for the most part. Sometimes they can be pretty pretty awful people, but for the most part, it's a blind spot. And you know, if I've got to rhetorically slap them down, it's because I want them to change, and not because, you know, I want to score rhetorical points or I want more views or followers or anything like that. So, I think I'm still wrestling with that aspect of engaging people on TikTok. It's been interesting. I've gotten to know a lot more perspectives than I ever have before. I've run for office here at home twice for the state legislature here in Utah. I've knocked on a lot of doors. I've talked with a lot of people, but this is a different kind of engagement, and I'm still learning from it. I'm learning about myself from it as well. Yeah, nobody's ever pulled this out of me so far on any of these podcast interviews.
I have a habit of doing that. I have occupied a similar position as you in spiritual circles, online, offline, mm-hmm. in discussing frauds and scammers and objectively looking at different kinds of spiritual claims and what is actually going on here. Because I think that it's important to look at things objectively, critically, so that you understand what's actually going on there. That way, you know that if you want to continue believing in something, or if you want to engage in, certain spiritual acts or rituals or things like that, that you're doing so from a place of faith, and that that's still perfectly valid and fair and good and great. But you know that that's what you're doing, mm-hmm. and you can sort of objectively separate the bunk claim from still the beautiful act of faith that you can still engage in. Do you resonate with that? Do you resonate with sort of the idea that you can engage in certain things to fulfill that sort of act of faith, that place of faith, while also understanding maybe objectively that the thing that we're saying is happening maybe isn't the thing that's happening?
I think there's a whole spectrum of ways we do that. And some of it, I think, could be construed as harmful. And I think there's mm-hmm. there's some of it that's not harmful. And there are a lot of folks who seem to be under the impression that the best life is one that is lived, you know, 100% rationally or something like that. And that's just not a possibility.
It's not as fun.
it's not as fun. It's not even human. I mean, we are designed to experience the world in a lot of different ways. And much of it is not entirely rational. And so, yeah, I don't agree with folks who think that if it's not rational, then it's not, then it's unethical, immoral, not good, something like that. And you know, there are a bunch of people who, the majority of people who have experienced what we label religion throughout human history, were probably operating in that gray area where they were experiencing something and maybe they didn't buy into it entirely. Maybe they rejected it entirely. Maybe they just weren't sure and decided they were going to go along and see if the thing could be found in the experiencing of it. I think that's probably the majority of folks who have engaged in what we label religion throughout human history, because the data, the research into religious experience and ritual and community and all these things would tell you that people are motivated not just by truth claims, not even primarily by truth claims, but by the experience of community and the good feelings that that brings and the unity that that can foster. And all different ways that those experiences bring people together and also allow people to curate their social identities and their social standing. And, you know, some of it's constructive, some of it's destructive. Some people manipulate it, some people take advantage of it. But yeah, I would rather folks enjoy that, even if they don't buy into it 100%, than people go around all day, every day saying, no, that's not rational. You're not allowed to do that. That's, I feel like sometimes there are some famous, popularizers of science who can sometimes come across that way.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Well, that's one of the main folks. Kind of takes the joy out of things.
Sucked the joy out of that full moon the other, just sucked the joy right out of that. It's like, I don't know, man. We were all just looking at a cool thing in the sky. It's like, I get that it's common, but it's still cool.
Yeah. I mean, let people enjoy things.
Let people enjoy things.
And yeah, I think there's the reply guy kind of model. I just, where people try to shut other people down because, you know, maybe they don't have all the facts right. Yeah, that just... Oh, that rubs me the wrong way. And I hope I don't come across that way, because I think I sometimes have a bit of a reputation for getting a little nitpicky about details, but there have been a number of details. I do too. And a lot of times I'll make a video where somebody they'll misspeak or they'll say something that's not exactly right, but you know, it would be pretty petty to bring it up. And it would just be about scoring points. And I'll overlook that. And I'll do it intentionally because I'm not there to hurt feelings. I'm not here to try to score every last point I can. And then people in the comments will be like, and they didn't even say that word right, or something like that. And I want to be like, you know, pronunciation isn't as big a deal as sometimes people make it out to be. You got to push me pretty hard to get me to correct your pronunciation. But yeah, let people enjoy things.
Do you think? Sorry.
Go ahead. No. I was just going to blather on some more. So
I wanted to ask, do you think that, because this is a conversation I've been having with other sort of thought leaders in my own community, do you think that the spiritual community as it exists online is the same spiritual community as it exists offline?
That's an interesting question, because that actually within Mormonism, and particularly the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I distinguish those two. One is a subset of the other, but they talk about chapel Mormons and internet Mormons, and they draw this dichotomy. And I've never liked that dichotomy. One, because I'm not a big dichotomy fan. I think that dichotomies are primarily about structuring power, and they kind of incentivize us overlooking nuance and
it's the black or white fallacy. There is either this or there is this, and there is nothing in between. Yeah.
And so I think there are definitely ways that certain aspects of the population will accrete around an online venue, whereas another segment of the population will accrete around a more in-person and less online thing. But to say there's a big division between those two, I don't think is fully accurate. But I think it's probably a spectrum of some kind or another. And I haven't studied how this goes on in all other faith communities. For me, I've focused on the internet and chapel Mormon debate. But yeah, I think there's something there. I haven't seen any research on that, but I'd be...
Oh, no, it seems to still be sort of a burgeoning idea that certain spiritual movements and churches and communities and things that, I don't know, the more that we sort of start existing online, especially in the last couple of years, the more we sort of start existing online and talking online and creating new kinds of echo chambers and things like that online, we're starting to have different discussions. There's different big names. There's different books that we recommend. There's different interpretations that we have of those books here. And those discussions they don't seem to translate to meet space, which is a term from the 90s I think we need to bring back. But those discussions don't seem to translate here. But likewise, the in-person discussions we used to have don't seem to creep their way online as much anymore. Yeah. It almost seems like we're having two different sets of conversations, and therefore two different movements are being created almost.
And I imagine there's a generational dimension to it as well. And obviously the discussions are going to be different between folks, who grew up in the 90s and folks who grew up in the aughts or even in the 10s. They're going to care about different things. They're going to prioritize different things. But yeah, I know there's a book called Liquid Scripture that was a discussion of how the consumption of the Bible in digital formats has changed how youth think about, conceptualize the Bible. If you pick up a hard copy, it's got a beginning, it's got a middle, it's got an end. It's kind of, there's a narrative there. And you've got to know, am I looking for the beginning? Am I looking for the middle? Am I looking for the end? And the verses are all there on a page. But if you have a device and you can just call up anything, and you don't even have to know the chapter, the verse, the book, or what order they're in, you can just search for a phrase or a word or a single passage, it kind of leads to a different conceptualization of what the Bible is. It's kind of an amorphous just collection that does not serve the same rhetorical functions that were served by early Christians putting the Old Testament into the order that it is, and differing from the Hebrew Bible and things like that. It's so that's an interesting book if you're interested in pursuing some of the ways that being online might change the way people think and talk about religiosity. That's the one example I can recall that I read recently.
You segue me really nicely into my next question. One of the things that when you get a little older in the church, your late teens, early 20s, that sort of starts blowing your mind. One of the first facts that blows your mind is, some older kid will take you aside and say, the Bible was hand selected by a crew of people in, X number of hundreds of years ago. So there's all these extra books.
Oh, yeah.
And there's all these extra books, right? And there's all these conspiracy theories. What's the truth about all that? Was there an Avengers of the church that was cobbling together what we know as the Bible? Are there all of these extra books around? What do those books mean? What does it mean to have extra books? And
I think there's a kernel of truth to a lot of that, but it's also so much more complex and I think so much more interesting. So the way that people deploy that fact, however, whatever the proximity to the actual fact, usually is, I think, misleading. For the most part, the Hebrew Bible, yes, before the first century CE, the Hebrew Bible included, there was no Hebrew Bible. No one referred to a Bible until after the first century CE. You had the scriptures. That's the Greek word. They were, you know, the books, the scrolls in Hebrew. But there was no, there was a large collection of them. A number of them were considered authoritative, but there was no formal official line that was drawn around a certain collection of books. So you had kind of a spectrum. The Torah was obviously the most authoritative, and you had this kind of rough division of the law and the prophets. And the law was considered higher than the prophets. But you had some other books in there. You know, at Qumran, we have Enoch was a very important book from the Hellenistic period. And that grew and accumulated more and more chapters over the centuries. And you had Jubilees and you had, you know, a bunch of texts where they took earlier texts and rewrote them or revised them. Some of those end up, you know, like the Genesis Apocryphon at Qumran. Some of them end up as the Targumim, the Aramaic translations. And it's around the first century that you start to see folks saying, we're dividing this collection. These are the authoritative ones. These are not. And it's more or less what we see in the Hebrew Bible today. What were the two? Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon, I believe, were the two books that got mentioned the most as being kind of debated. And it's very interesting in the first century debate. The debate is about whether or not they defiled the hands. And these were folks who were sincerely trying to figure out what books should have authority in our community and what books should not. And it wasn't about trying to manipulate people. It wasn't about getting rid of dangerous things as much as it was about needing an answer and needing to find out where to draw the line. And that's with the Hebrew Bible. When you get into Christianity, you have this explosion of texts late first century into the second century, and you have a lot of Gnostic texts. This was kind of the main competitor of what you might call Orthodox Christianity in the second century. The Gnostics, which were kind of combining this Neoplatonic conception of the creation of the universe and of the heavens with Christian scripture. And so you have the Demiurge, and you have, which is this evil God that they equated with Adonai in the Hebrew Bible. And Jesus was bringing this higher knowledge and this light and this escape from the material world. And so you have a lot of those texts that became very popular. And you had a lot of the other texts that became canonical. Probably by the mid second century, you have most of the texts that we now consider canonical, but you also had a few extra. The Shepherd of Hermas, the Epistle of Barnabas, and the Didache or the Didache. Those three, if there were any books that people always ask me what should have been included in the Bible, but wasn't, I would say for the New Testament, those three were the closest to texts that should have been included, but ultimately were left out. And you have these all circulated independently. And so different communities just had their books that they liked to read. And in the third and fourth century CE, you get the same thing within Christianity. We need to draw a line around these books. And the question that they asked was, what are the congregations reading? What are considered authoritative by the churches? And you had a lot of the leadership that was trying to combat the influence of Gnostics. So, you know, when they were deemed heretical, the books would be banned. Some of them would be burned. Some people were probably executed at one point or another by different leaders at various levels in the ecclesiastical order. But around the fourth century, the books kind of start to get sifted out. And you, by the time that they are going around and asking everybody, you know, we're going to make a formal decision, we want to know what books are being used, you more or less have the New Testament as it's found today. And there are a lot of theories about, you know, Athanasius was the only one who wanted the book of Revelation in there because he thought it talked about him or something like that. I've never seen any data that support that conclusion. These were, for the most part, well-meaning people who were, you know, lived in a problematic world where they were structuring power in ways that we would not find acceptable anymore. But they were trying to do what they thought was best for their community. And so there are a lot of conspiracy theories, you know, Constantine did it at Nicaea or on his own, or the Vatican got rid of all these books in 1684 or some other made up year. And most of those are just attributing motivations to the individuals who have been linked with some of these changes. And there is no factual basis for the attribution of those motivations. It's people trying to figure out what's going to work the best for our community, what texts are most likely to be inspired by God. And they kind of retrofitted the criteria that they came up with. Some people say that, you know, there are a list of criteria, but that was kind of retconned a little bit. They basically said, these are all the books that the most people seem to be using. And they said, great, those are the books we'll consider authoritative. And then they rationalized why it should be these and not all these others that got left out. And so it was kind of a messy, complex process that was not nearly as sinister or organized or deceptive as a lot of people want to think. But yeah, there, I think we have access to a lot of these books now that were left out, that were considered authoritative for a long, long time. And I think it helps us better understand, gives us a broader view of what early Judaism and early Christianity was like when these books were in circulation and were popular, because they frequently tell very different stories about early Judaism and early Christianity. And some of them are very, very weird.
Speaking of telling different stories and conspiracy theories, you work in translation. Mm-hmm. And every now and then, some new conspiracy theory runs rampant online or in some documentary somewhere, or certainly on the History Channel, you know, telling, oh gosh, there's this translation we've been getting all wrong this whole time. And actually, Jesus had seven legs, or, you know, somebody breathed fire, who knows? You know, we had these books a long, long, long time now. Do we really not know what they say? Or,
well, because a lot of the meaning that we find in them is stuff that either is meaningful to us or that we have had to reconstruct from antiquity. There are sometimes when we make discoveries and we find data that suggests maybe something did mean something a little different, and we've just never considered it because our contexts are so much different from theirs. So there are still times, like every time somebody says, oh, this should be understood an entirely different way, I try to take it seriously, because I would not want to flippantly dismiss something that actually turned out to be very, very insightful. But at the same time, if it is something that happens to support some kind of current fad or some kind of movement or something like that, I will be a little more suspicious when I look at it. But yeah, we discover things all the time that help us better reconstruct the interpretive lenses that would have been used anciently. So for instance, the Dead Sea Scrolls helped us in a lot of ways understand how they were using words. For one thing, it just provided a much larger corpus of texts from which we can derive ideas about how they use these words. The Ugaritic texts were huge because that showed us a Northwest Semitic language from the centuries before Hebrew developed as a language. So that showed us basically the house that Hebrew grew up in, and helped us understand we've been interpreting this verbal root this one way since, you know, the second or third century, because that's how the rabbis interpreted it. But it turns out it, you know, meant something a lot different. So I would never dismiss on the face of it claims that we've misinterpreted something for you know, two millennia. That's not only possible, it happens, and we know it happens. But I am cautious about that. So I would say I'm cautiously optimistic every time somebody suggests that they found a new way to translate something.
So how cautiously optimistic are you that the entire Bible is just one long hallucination caused by mushrooms?
Yeah, that's, oh golly. That is based on a lot of very, very specious reasoning and a lot of assertions about what they think something meant and about conspiracy theories that they were trying to hide this information from the Romans. And so they encoded everything. And anybody who's ever read codes would look at the text of the New Testament and their contradictions and their complexities and be like, this was a pretty worthless code. Like, this is, nobody would be like, ah, that's what it means. On the whole, it just would be laughable as an encoding of this secret society. But generally, you know, with some few exceptions, generally the academic consensus frequently is close to the truth. So if somebody published something 30, 40, 50 years ago, and most of the academy went, that's not helpful. That's the position from which I'm going to be starting. And you know, far more often than not, that's the position I end up at the end. And hopefully I'm approaching things objectively and I'm taking the data seriously. I'm sure there are times I've gotten it wrong, but yeah, some of the conspiracy theories and the crackpot theories, I've wasted a lot of hours trying to give them a fair trial.
How many times a day do you get asked about the Da Vinci Code?
Not that frequently. I get asked about the immortality key far more frequently.
What's that?
It's a book. I've not read it, but it's basically one of these. This is all an encoding of this secret society kind of stuff, and so it has to do with. I want to say there's some hallucinogenic stuff to it about the origins of Christianity and things like that, but it was written by a non-specialist and caused a lot of waves. I think I want to say maybe 10, 15 years ago. I've not read the book, and people ask me about it, and I mentioned I've wasted a lot of hours trying to give them a fair trial, and so this is not a book that I have been willing to put on my docket yet. But that's one, the Da Vinci Code, more often than not, that gets mentioned when I respond to somebody and say, no, 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 no. And somebody comes in and is like, that sounds like the Da Vinci Code. That's nonsense. I don't get drilled for, engagement with Da Vinci Code stuff much at all, really.
Is there a conspiracy theory you wish were real? Or it would be fun if it were real.
If something with the Masons or the Knights Templars or something like that, something from the Inquisition period, that would be fascinating.
I always come down more on the side of like. You know, the unicorns in the Bible or the giants, you know, all of that kind of thing. I would much rather the Bible be supportive of the Lord of the Rings or something like that. That's
I'm pretty sure it is. that's not a conspiracy theory though.
Yeah. You know, Deuteronomy 3:12 and Gandalf said, thou shalt not pass.
Fool of a Took is in there somewhere too.
Somewhere it has to be. It absolutely has to be. You know, I'm going to be respectful of your time, Dan McClellan. Thank you so much for being here on Head on Fire. If folks want to get in touch with you, where can they do so online?
So I mentioned my handle, MAKLELAN. That's me on YouTube, on Instagram, on Twitter, and on TikTok. And my, I'm on Facebook too, but I don't have a public page on there. It's just my own personal page where
Facebook's hell.
Yeah. And yeah, I also have a blog. It's kind of defunct. I haven't used it for a long time, but people will frequently get on there to try and send me messages. If you can't do it on TikTok or Twitter, and you don't want to do it on Instagram, if you go to danielomcclellan.wordpress.com, I have a blog there, and you can message me if you want to get in touch with me there. And I think that's pretty much all of my public social media stuff. I'm trying to grow my YouTube channel, but it turns out making 20-minute videos takes a little longer than making one and three minute videos.
It does. It is not fun. Well, Dan McClellan, thank you so much for being here. I value your time. I hope folks will go follow you. And thanks so much for what you're doing. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you. And I hope I haven't rambled too much. I have a tendency,
the exact correct amount.
I have a tendency of trying to seek out my thoughts and repeating myself until I kind of hone in on exactly what it is I want to say. And sometimes that wastes a lot of time. So yeah, I appreciate your time.
When writing a book, I always have to get some friends and kind of spitball. And the draft is this big and the final is that.
Oh,
big.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. My dissertation was almost 1,000 pages at one point, and I got it down to, I think, 530 or something like that. But
what a sacrifice.
It was fun, though. I enjoyed every minute of it. Well, thank you for your time and for the opportunity to talk with you and the really thoughtful questions. I appreciate it.
Well, folks, that's going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My eternal gratitude to my guest, Dan McClellan. I really hope that this interview gave you some hope about the kinds of conversations that are happening out there, the kinds of voices that we have speaking up and speaking out about important issues and doing so from an informed place, from within certain communities. I know that when I found Dan's platform, I was just overjoyed to have a voice like that speaking up and using his platform to do so much good. So thank you so much, Dan, for being on the show. I hope that you all do go follow him. If you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Share it with your friends on social media. You can also like or rate the show 5 stars on places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, leave a review. Even if it's just a few emojis, reviews really help the show be recommended to other listeners like you. If you've got a little jingle in your pocket, you can help keep the show free and producing regularly by joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and a monthly book club. This month, we're reading Bad Gaze. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. If you want to connect with me on social media, I'm pretty much at headonfirepod everywhere. Thanks so much for tuning in. And remember, the Bible is not a mass hallucination brought on by mushrooms. Happy Pride Month, everybody.